Episode 17, Season 2 of The Bad Apples. Hey everyone, today I've got a great interview with someone you will recognize right away. Turns out this guy's really knowledgeable in multimedia support on Linux. He's a programmer. He knows Asterisk. Pretty much everything I'm interested in, this guy was talking about. So turned out to be just a really interesting interview. And and he doesn't like Macs, so there you go. That was kind of an added bonus. So I'll play that in a minute. Yeah, I think you'll really like it. Now the couple of the traditional house cleaning stuff. I'm going to the National Association of Broadcasters convention, which is held each year in Las Vegas. It's going to cover a lot of production and post-production topics, mostly hardware. Probably, although the obligatory Avid booth, the obligatory Final Cut Pro booth, I'm sure. You know, the typical software vendors will be there, including Autodesk. And Autodesk is a company that does a program called Smoke, which is a professional-grade video editing software, which is released for Linux and available for Linux. It's not free in any sense of the word, but it is a video editor and it does run on Linux. So I'm going to be looking at that with great interest, I'm sure. And I'll be looking at some of the new cameras and things like that, trying to figure out where all this stuff kind of is positioned in relation to a Linux video editing workflow. So that should be interesting. The flip side of that is probably I won't have a whole lot to, I'll probably miss next week podcast simply because I'll be busy. If not, you'll hear from me. Now the week after that, I am going up to some training for work that I have to do, and I'm kind of in the middle of a job move and things like that, so kind of getting some extra training on some stuff, so I'll be gone for that week as well. But I think that's not going to interfere quite as much with the podcasting, because I'll have a hotel room all my own, and I should be able to get some stuff out that week. Now another thing you might want to do, given the topic of this episode, is sign on IRC when the Linux Link Tech Show is airing, when they record it on Wednesday nights. They actually have a live IRC session going during the recording, and everyone in there kind of talks about whatever they want. Sometimes it even stays on the topic of the show. The easiest way to do this would be to get on IRSSI. Now, if you're not into IRC, you can certainly get into it easily enough. In Linux, you've got a lot of different IRC clients. XChat, Pigeon, IRSSI, Mibit, BitchX. There's a lot of different clients will do IRC. And if you don't know how to IRC, I did an IRC overview in, I think, episode either 202 or... Yeah, I think it was actually 202. So go back into the archives and look around for that. But in a nutshell, again, just like I say, and I think it is episode 202, I think the one that I find easiest, actually, to get started with is IRSSI, ERC, or IRC, or however people say it, simply because it's command line and it's very straightforward. So to get started, just to kind of feel it out if you're not into it yet, simply go to the command line, type in IRSSI space dash dash nick, N-I-C-K, space your nickname. So whatever nickname you want to have. You can pretty much choose any nickname, although you should try to make it unique. And just starting out, if you haven't registered your nickname, you won't be able to do certain things like private message and things like that. But I mean, if you're just starting out, who cares? You know, you can get to that point later. IRSSI will then start, and you'll be expected to tell it what server you want to go on to. You can do /server, S-E-R-V-E-R, space, the linuxlink.net, and then you want to /join, space, hash, tech show. And do that on Wednesday night when they're recording the show, which is 8:30 Eastern Standard Time, USA. Then you will be able to join in on all the fun. So do that, and get on IRC. It'll be fun. You can find me usually in IRC Freenode server, which is sort of the most popular one, I guess. usually hanging around in the Lotta Linux Link channel. I'm in Linux Reality, Linux Basement, Linux Outlaws. Yeah, I will see you there. Here's the interview. Pat from the Linux Link Tech Show, how are you doing?
Excellent. How are you doing, Clato?
Pretty good. So you're a professional podcaster, right? That's what you do all day. You podcast.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
No, by day, I'm a professional programmer in the IT industry, financial industry. I've got about 13 years experience doing programming full time as my main income. The tech show I've been involved with since around, they came on as an official member around episode 75 or so.
Okay.
But I knew the guys before then. I knew them because they started the Lehigh Valley Lug, and I was pretty good friends with them before that. And around the time they started doing the tech show, my first son was born, so I was a little busy with the little one.
Yeah.
And I came, actually, they gave me a shout-out, I think, maybe the fifth or sixth episode around the time my son was born. And then I came on around, I think it was around episode 50 or so. I came on for, like, a guest segment. I did a thing on MIT-TV.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so, you know, we're at episode 240, so it's been a while.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm amazed that you guys have been doing that for so long. It's really cool. I mean, obviously, everyone listening to my show probably has heard Linux Link Tech Show, so I probably don't need to pimp you guys that much. But
Nah, we don't need to do the podcast circle jerk.
Yeah. But so you're into MIT-TV, huh?
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm really into. Besides programming, I'm really into, like, the multimedia stuff, and I've played around with MIT-TV for a long time. I think the very first time I installed it was around when Fedora 1 was around. Fedora 1, Fedora 2, and
wow.
I did it on Fedora at the time.
Oh, that's cool.
Because Jared Wilson has a really awesome how-to on MIT-TV, building it from, you know, using Fedora, and I used his method the first time I built it, and it was pretty straightforward, you know. Granted, someone, you know, without any computer experience at the time, probably couldn't have done it too easily. They probably wouldn't pull their hair out.
Right.
But if you were, like, halfway technical and you followed the how-to, it was pretty straightforward, and that's a project that's come a long way. I mean, you look at it now, you have specific Linux distributions like NotMyth,
yeah,
Mythbuntu,
yeah.
Mythbora, which are Linux distributions where it's basically, you know, just pop the DVD or CD into the drive, turn it on, and you're on your way.
Right, yeah.
It's pretty minimal configuration compared to what it used to be like. And I really love that. My main DVR is a MIT-TV box upstairs in the family room. Now, mind you, I've had other DVRs. I used to have DirecTV,
yeah,
and Dish Network, and I had their DVRs, and they were very basic, those DVRs. It was just basically, you know, just record, you know, a TV show, you know, so many hours on the hard drive they gave you.
Yeah.
And that was pretty much it. And in fact, I have one now with my high-definition cable box. They gave me, for whatever reason, they never charged me for it, so I'm not
nice.
Going to return it, you know,
right.
Unless I get a bill in the mail for, you know, $300 or whatever next month, but it doesn't seem likely. It's been over a year now. And to be honest, I really don't use that DVR much. I just use that for, like, some high-definition stuff I might want to record if I'm not home.
Yeah.
But the vast majority of my TV viewing is done with MIT-TV. And, you know, the recording of the TV shows is just a very basic functionality of it. There's so much more that you can do with it. It really is like a multimedia front end for, like, a home theater type setup.
Yeah, and you can hook it up to your own, like, media server, right? And just kind of use it as almost
Well, it is a media
point.
Server.
Okay.
I mean, there's all sorts of setups that you could do with it. You know, you can have it just as a standalone unit. The software components, it has like a front end and a back end. The back end has like a MySQL database front end where, you know, the shows are recorded and cataloged along with, you know, the show details, you know, that it pulls down to show information. And the front end component is all the GUIs and all the plugins that people have developed for it.
Yeah.
They can be physically on the same box, but you can have setups where you have one main box and multiple front ends around the house.
Wow.
And the front ends are able to access all the shows that are recorded on the main box. Besides the TV shows, you can have music on there. There's like a Myth weather plugin, so that you can set up your zip code. You can get your weather forecast with radar maps.
Cool.
It has a Netflix plugin where you, if you have a Netflix account, you can go in and set movies to put into your queue.
Yeah, that's
so
cool.
On your queue. You can browse the Netflix catalog. You can archive the shows that you recorded to either a DVD or re-encode them to other formats like XVID or DivX.
Wow.
MP4. There's a plugin to hook up an Asterisk server to
oh,
it.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's really insane amount of stuff. The basic basic functionality is the TV recording plus the music playing. It also has, you can play audio, online audio, radio stations now and now too.
That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's really awesome what you could do with it.
Funny, because basically, I mean, that's sort of just the status quo for most Linux stuff, really. You know, just take some basic idea and then just start expanding it to, like, every possible thing that it can do.
I have, like, a whole slew of my media, like my photos,
yeah,
my music collection, some other, you know, TV shows and home videos that I've recorded. And I have them sitting on my main server. And what I do is I just share out an NFS share
mm-hmm.
over the network. And I just, you know, set up in my Mythbox settings, I can point it to the NFS shares. And I can access all that stuff, you know, all my photos and my music. And it really is great. You know, anytime I have company over, family and friends and stuff, you know, I always got to kick just showing them what it could do.
I'm sure, yeah.
And it wasn't very expensive to put together. I mean, I think I put it together with some spare parts. You know, you need like a TV capture card, a standard small form factor case if you want to go that route. See, I went the small form factor case because I like it to fit in with my home theater components.
Yeah, yeah.
It just looks like another component in my rack and, you know, it could be an audio receiver. You couldn't tell just looking at it.
Yeah, and so does the TV capture card, does that typically have the onboard graphics memory that you need to drive it?
No, or? Well, there are different capture cards that you can use. Like, the very first time I set up my TV, I used the Hopog 350, which was like their heavy-duty card.
Yeah.
And what the Hopog 350 card was, it has a chip on there to do encoding of the shows on the fly, that thing
wow.
too. And it also had on the back end another chip to decode the shows during playback. So what that card let you do was you could set that up on a very fairly low-powered machine, and you can get away with it. But machines have, you know, progressed in the years since that card came out. And now what most people do is they get the Hopog 150 card, which is a much cheaper card, and it just has the encoder portion. And all my video out stuff is all done by my onboard video.
Gotcha. Yeah.
I have an Asus motherboard that has like an NVIDIA 6150 video card on it.
Yeah,
and that has component out, so
okay.
It does high def. Even though I currently don't have it set up on the TV upstairs, it's high def. It will do it.
Cool.
Yeah, and I mean, there's all sorts of video cards that people use. For instance, if you're doing high definition capturing, if you have a cable box, there's an FCC regulation where cable companies have to have their FireWire ports working. So that means that you could just hook up a FireWire cable and capture high def video over the FireWire cable using transport streams.
Wow, I did not know about that.
That's yeah, so really cool. You don't even need a capture card if you're doing HD and you have a cable company with a working FireWire port. The only caveat to that is sometimes the cable companies, depending on which cable company you have, will put the encryption on the premium channels.
Right.
So your premium channels like your HBOs and Showtimes
yeah.
might not be able to be captured. So mileage varies depending on who your provider is. Now, for some reason, the satellite companies, they're not held to that regulation. So I know DirecTV used to have boxes with FireWire ports that worked on them,
yeah.
but they don't do that anymore, and neither does Dish Network. So you have a couple different options to do that with a satellite dish, HD capture. There's this company, I forget the name, I think it's 169TV. They do like mods to like the satellite boxes, but it's really expensive. It's like something like $500-$600 to do
yeah.
a mod to put a FireWire port on there. One good thing that's happening is that Hopog, you know, which makes a ton of cards,
yeah.
a lot of them are supported in Linux, they're coming out with a new HD capture, I guess it's a little box that you hook up.
Yeah, like a converter, an external converter.
Yeah, a little yeah. box. And what it is basically just an encoder, an external encoder, USB
yep.
connection.
Yeah.
That's coming out, I think, at May 1st, I think the release date is. That'll be nice because you'll be able to hook it up to your component outs. And I guess that falls into so-called analog hole.
Oh, okay.
So they're able to skirt, you know, the digital capture.
Yeah.
DMCA laws that are out there now.
Very nice.
So, yeah, so I think that's going to sell for, I think the introductory price, we're talking $250. It's a little steep, but I'm sure that'll drop.
It's actually not that bad, too. I mean, for a hardware encoding device, and hardware encoding is kind of the way to go. I mean, you don't want your software or your system components having to do the encoding for you.
Right,
you
know? Right. So that's nice, because I think that particular device is going to do X264 on the fly.
Yeah, very cool.
Which is really good, because if anybody's out there like me and is stupid enough to buy an HD DVD player,
right,
and movies that came with it,
yeah,
I can hook up this little device, play my DVDs through there, and encode them to new files in high definition.
Right.
My files will have my HD DVDs off the DVDs and be able to put them on my MythBox or just put them on my media server or whatever.
So how'd you end up with an HD DVD player?
You thought
they were going to beat Blu-ray?
You know what? It was pretty equal footing. This is going back like during the fall.
Yeah.
And I work with a guy who's a real audio video file, and he bought both a Blu-ray and a DVD HD DVD player, and he said that the quality was very comparable as far as, you know, the picture and the audio and everything.
Yeah,
and
I mean, it's all 25 megabit per second video, and so it just looks great.
I think they even use the same encoders.
They do, as far as I know.
You know,
they did.
Yeah, so he was like, it's a toss-up, so he hedged his bets and bought both devices, you know, both players. So they had a sale on, like, on Black Friday for $159 from Amazon. So, and they gave you 10 movies. They gave you 5 movies up front,
and then
they shipped you another 5 movies. So for $159, I got an HD DVD player with 10 free movies, you know, pretty good titles. I bought one title, Transformers, because at the time it was HD DVD only, and I got my 10 movies. And it is a decent upscaling DVD player.
Yeah.
So if you pop your standard definition DVDs in there, it looks really nice going on a high definition set. It does a nice job of it.
Oh, that's cool.
So I figured for $159, even if it loses the format war, I have a decent upscaling DVD player.
Yeah.
So they did lose the war. So.
They did lose it. And now in 10 years, you'll have major geek points for having one of those in your closet, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, so the whole thing is, you know, I would like that Hot Pog HDVD recorder. I'll probably play my movies through there and re-encode them to X264 HD, and I'll be able to burn them down the road. So all is not lost. And I found out today, there was an article in Ars Technica that anybody, like a lot of the retailers that sold HD DVD players are giving either store credits or refunds or partial refunds. I happen to buy mine from Amazon. I found that Amazon gives you a $50 credit, store credit.
Oh, wow.
So I didn't get anything via email from them. So what I did was I shot an email off to customer support. And sure enough, I got a response back pretty quickly saying, yeah, we're giving you a $50 credit. So
wow,
for $109, I got an HD DVD player that's a nice upscaling DVD player, plus 10 movies that are high def.
That's fantastic.
$109, you know, big deal.
Yeah, no kidding. No, that's actually really good. So what are the distros of your, I mean, you mentioned Fedora early on, I guess, as your myth basis, but what distros are you running now?
Well, I used Fedora in the very beginning for myth, but eventually I went on to not myth and myth Ubuntu, and currently I'm running myth Ubuntu right now.
Okay.
I've been running that for about a year now, and I'm pretty happy with that on myth. As far as my history of regular Linux distribution usage,
yeah,
I started off around 1998 with Red Hat 5.0, I think it was, and I would go to the big box electronics stores and buy the Red Hat releases from there. I think I got like 6, 6.1, 6.2, and I think the last version of Red Hat that I actually bought and used was Red Hat 7, and they pissed a lot of people off at the time because they used their own version of GCC compiler.
Ooh.
That wasn't compatible with what everybody else used.
Oh, and, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. It was a real, around at the time, it was a big, you know, brouhaha.
Yeah.
So around 2000, I got married and I moved to the Lehigh Valley, and I started going to the Lehigh Valley Linux user group, and I met the guys there, Dan Link and Alan and a whole bunch of other people, and they were really big time into Slackware. So
right.
I got on the Slackware bandwagon, and I ran Slackware for about 2 years as my main distribution.
Cool.
And Slackware is really nice. It's very stable. It's very Unix-like.
Yeah.
You learn a lot using it. But eventually, I got a little tired with it, and I migrated over to Debian.
Yeah.
And I ran Debian as my main distro for about 2 years. until that hard drive died. And I think after that, what did I go to? I think I went to Canonics, which was Debian Derivative. It was based on Debian Unstable.
Yeah, they just recently kind of stopped, didn't they?
Yeah, a couple of years ago they died.
Yeah.
And after Canonics, I played around with Ubuntu when they first came out. I also tried Arch Linux.
Yeah, yeah.
And those two are my main favorites right now, Ubuntu and Arch Linux. Arch is nice because it kind of melds like the Slackware type distros with the Debian type distros, with throwing a little bit of Gentoo, and you got Arch.
Cool.
Now Arch is a binary based distro. There's all packages for it.
Oh, okay.
So it's not like Gentoo where you're spending countless hours just compiling
everything. Yeah.
Yeah, I've done two stage one Gentoo installs in my life, and I think that's enough for me for that.
Yeah,
we'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I did one, and I don't think I ever got it through at all. So yeah,
I got them completed, and I was running them. I ran Gentoo for maybe 3 weeks or so, and 48 hours to compile a KDE was a bit much for me.
Yeah,
but people like that, more power to them.
Wow, Pat's talking so much, I think we can sneak away for a coffee break. Let's go get one and come right back before he stops. So your other computers there in the house are all Macs, is that correct?
No, I don't have any Mac. I've never owned a Mac, to be honest. My computing history is that way back in the day, my very first computer was a Commodore VIC-20. I was about, 11 years old at the time. And then eventually we got a Commodore 64. Me and my brother, we shared the machines. My parents got us Commodore.
Yeah.
And after that, I graduated to an Amiga. And the Amiga was an awesome machine at the
time. That's what everyone says, yeah, yeah.
Amazing. I remember when we had the Amiga, I was in high school. And I went to college, and I got a job working in the university computing center. And at the time, they had some PCs, and they had some Macs in the corner. So I played around with the Mac at the time, and I tried out the Mac. This was the very first Macintosh, and it was black and white.
Yeah.
And I'm like, my Amiga blows this machine away. Why?
Yeah.
After the Amiga scene Commodore got run into the ground by some bad management practice, and it was a real shame because the Amiga was a really amazing machine, really ahead of its time, some of the things that you could do with it. And after that I got into PC clones. I started running Windows. I think I ran like Windows 3.0, 3.1, 95. And then around 95 or something, like 98, I kind of got tired of it a little bit. And I was going back to college for my master's degree, and I got exposed to, in my job, some of the Unix guys were playing around with Linux, and they were running an Apache web server on a Slackware build, and this is before there was the concept of intranet, these little in-house internet kind of deals where, you could share ideas and post pages between different work groups and stuff. So that was my very first contact with Linux, and I went back to college, and I played around with it more, and then I moved to the Lehigh Valley, and the rest is history. Some guys had Atari 400s.
Right.
Some guys had TIs. A lot of people had Commodore.
And Apple IIs.
Yeah, Apple IIs are a lot. Oh, some guys had Atari 400s.
Right.
Some guys had TIs. A lot of people had Commodore.
And Apple IIs.
Yeah, Apple. Some guys had Atari 400s.
Right.
Some guys had TIs. I got into programming with the Commodore 64. I programmed the game using sprites that, I created this little enterprise blasting the planet. And, I was controlling six sprites at once. Oh, my God.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah, I was doing, I think it was HyperCard stuff. That was as programmy as I got. It was sort of multimedia-esque.
Right. And then, I got more into, the real programming when I was going to college. But I wasn't a computer science major in college. I was actually a business major.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but I always liked doing the computer stuff. And once I started working in the real world, and I was doing business stuff, working in the financial world,
yeah,
for brokerage, and I really didn't care for it. So, you know, they were looking for people to do in-house programming, and I went that route, and I really got into it. And then eventually I went back to school for my master's degree in computer science. You know, I got exposed to some different things, some Unix, some Linux, some web development, and, you know, it's great stuff, you know. There's so much that you could do with computer systems, that, and, you know, so much out there that's easily and freely available.
Yeah.
You know, Linux, you know, BSDs, there's so much stuff that you can play with and learn, and you could really acquire skills.
Yeah, and it's cool because, I mean, computers are I think, I mean, well, obviously they're more powerful than they ever have been, you know, previously, but they're still growing a lot, you know, I mean, it's just always developing, so people getting into it now not only can do really cool things, but they can also, like, pioneer so much.
Oh, yeah, one area that's really exploding is the embedded Linux area. You know, all these different small form factor devices.
Yeah.
And pick a device and try to do some coding on it, man. You can really do some really interesting, cool stuff out there. You know, OpenMoco, the Nokia N800 series.
The Chumby.
The Chumby. There's so many cool devices out there.
Yeah, there are.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's the Google Android. There's even the Apple iPhone.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Pick one and start learning how to code for it, man. You could really, you know, make a profession for yourself going forward.
Yeah, I think someone hacked, I heard on some show, someone hacked Android onto a Nokia N810. That sounded kind of cool.
I guess. I mean, from what I've seen of Android, it's pretty high up in the stack.
Yeah.
It seems to be mostly like user space apps.
Oh, okay.
And a framework around it. You know, where else, like a device like the OpenMoco is more really low level. You can really get down and dirty with it.
Right, yeah.
That's a device that I got to play around with a few months back.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they got a review copy or something.
Yeah, what it was is they created a version that didn't have one of the main frequencies. That's in North America, the 850 megahertz spectrum.
Yeah.
Which is not really used in the rest of the world, but in the Western Hemisphere, it's more prevalent, like in rural areas. So they didn't include that initially on their first version, the development version of it, and they packed up a bunch of phones, modified versions with to enable 850 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
So they were looking for testers, so I volunteered, and I had the phone for about a week, and it was a pretty interesting device. I think I'm looking forward to buying the new version when it comes out. They've been talking about it being released anywhere since like last fall till now, and it hasn't come out yet. My guesstimate, reading the mailing list, is probably going to come out in the next 2 to 4 months would be my guess, and I'm probably going to get that one if I have the cash available.
Yeah, it should be really nice. I saw, I guess, whatever version is out right now at scale, and it was a really cool little phone.
That's right. Michael Sheila was there, who was like the community manager.
Cool. Yeah, I guess I probably met him then. But yeah, it was a neat little phone. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, the new version is going to have Wi-Fi, so that's going to be a big deal, because if you have like an Asterisk server, you'll be able to get any old VoIP client working with it.
Yeah, that's so cool.
It's very cool.
Yeah, well, the iPhone is something that is, I mean, for as much press as it's generated, it's just, I think it's amazing at how limited the capabilities are compared to, like, the OpenMoco. And I mean, even the Nokia N800, I mean, not being a phone, but, I mean, just in terms of the expandability.
Hey, have you played around with it? Or do you own one?
What, the iPhone?
Yeah, do you have an iPhone?
I had an iPhone given to me as a gift, and I actually traded it for a Nokia N800, and it was the best trade I'd ever made.
Slightly different target audiences.
It is, and yeah, but the one thing about the iPhone that I never had used or really used was the cell phone part of it, so it was a good trade for me.
You like playing with the apps.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the Nokia is all about the apps.
Yeah, yeah, so it was good.
They're both nice devices, they're very different, and I think the target audiences are kind of different.
Very different, yeah. The one thing about the iPhone that is nice is that the multi-touch screen that they've got, and I don't know that any other device has that right now.
No, I don't think so, not yet. I know there was a boatload of clones that came out during CES in Vegas in January.
Yeah.
But I don't think any of those have come to market yet. I like the OpenMoco because I like the whole concept of it being an open platform.
Yes, yeah.
That's not tied to any one vendor or any one cell provider.
Yeah, it makes so much sense.
And it's freaking cool turning it on and seeing the Linux boot up come up.
Right. That is cool. What kind of little processor is in there in the OpenMoco? Do you know?
I think it's an ARM. The version that I played around with, I think it was 233 megahertz, and I think the one that's coming out is going to be 400 megahertz.
Wow, not bad.
Yeah, it's pretty powerful for a tiny little device.
Yeah.
Those ARM processors are used in a lot of devices these days. The version that I played around with, I think, was 233 megahertz, and I think the one that's coming out is going to be 400 megahertz.
Wow, not bad.
Yeah, it's pretty powerful then.
Okay.
I think that has an ARM9 in it, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, actually. So compiling under different CPUs, like, is that ever an issue for you? Do you mainly stay with like Intel, AMD kind of stuff, or?
I used to be all Intel, but my main workstation is an AMD 64. My server is an AMD 64, and my MythBox is an AMD 64. And,
oh, wow, so are you all 64 bit pretty much then?
I got two x86 boxes. I got a machine that I use for Ardour strictly.
Yeah.
That's x86, and I have a piece of crap laptop that I got from Walmart that's x86. That's dying slowly.
Yeah.
And honestly, AMD 64 is pretty stable. It's pretty robust. I like it.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of good things about them. I've never actually used them, though, but I'll be looking to buy a tower at some point.
The only issue if you run 64-bit Linux is Flash. They don't have a native version for it.
Yeah, you know what? Flash is, like, so low on my priority. I can't stand Flash. If Flash went away tomorrow, I'd be so happy.
You have a couple of options. What you could do is you could run a 64-bit version of Firefox, and you can use this NS plugin wrapper.
Okay.
And use the 32-bit Flash on the 64-bit browser.
Yeah.
Or you could just run a 32-bit browser with your 32-bit plugins.
Oh, right. Okay, well, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can run 32-bit apps on a 64-bit install. Like, there's a few 32-bit apps that I have on here, like Gizmo, Skype.
Yeah.
A couple others, but that's about it.
You know, so Gizmo is actually, I mean, what is the deal with Gizmo? I mean, we're recording on it right now, and I didn't realize that I couldn't find the source code on their site to install from source.
It's not open source.
I did not know that. I thought they were.
The only thing that's open about it is they let you use SIP protocol.
Okay.
So you can use Gizmo to connect to an NAT server.
The asterisk or something. Yeah, okay.
But it's a closed source program.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was trying to install it on my PowerPC Slackintosh machine, and yeah, I just wouldn't do it because obviously it was binary.
Yep, you can't do it. Huh. So what your options are, you can use a SIP client, a soft phone. There are some open source soft clients that you could use, like Akiga, AIX phone, SJ phone. There's a whole bunch of them. If you go look out there, K phone.
Yeah.
If you go look, you'll see, just do a search on SIP clients.
Yeah.
And you'll see a whole bunch of apps out there for it. Asterisk is a great application.
Yeah, so have you, I mean, obviously you've got, so do you run the Asterisk server for tilts, or?
Initially, I had it. It was my old workstation. Actually, it was my old MythBox. It was an 800 megahertz machine.
Cool.
And I initially did the setup on it, and eventually we moved into Dan's place, because that's where we used to do the show from when he was living up here in the Lehigh Valley, and eventually he moved down to Virginia, so. But the Asterisk box went down there with him, so he's the main admin of the Asterisk box now.
Okay. Have you looked into the little distro Slast?
I haven't played around with it, but it looks pretty cool. What
it does look cool. I downloaded it. I'm going to start playing around with it probably this weekend. So, yeah.
Asterisk is a great application. It really is. You can set one of those puppies up in your house and. For $20, that could be like your main phone system.
Yeah, that's so cool.
And you can pick up like these SIP phones, these budget home SIP phones for like $30-$40.
Yeah.
You know, and have voicemail and call forwarding and all sorts of fancy stuff.
That's great.
I mean, you could set up an Asterisk server by itself and it won't cost anything. But if you want to get like a real world phone, you'll have to get a provider. And we use BroadVoice, and I think the basic plan, I think, is like $15.
Mm-hmm.
We have like an unlimited account for like $30, or not even $30, $25, I think we pay.
Wow.
A month, and I use that thing quite a bit.
Cool. So are you completely free of phone companies, basically?
Not entirely. I still have a phone connection through the cable company.
Okay.
Which is VoIP too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I did one of those bundle deals where, you know, you got
digital,
your cable TV and then your phone system. And it is slightly cheaper than if you if you did, you know, ad hoc services. And the service is pretty good. It even works if the power's out, which is kind of odd. Most VoIP goes out once the power's out.
Right, yeah, that's what I would have thought.
But these guys have some kind of a backup system where, you know, the funnels will work if the power's out.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I have RCN, which I believe is owned by Paul Allen now.
Huh.
And I've been pretty happy with it, the cable connection. I can't complain about it.
Yeah, yeah, that's cool.
It's not Comcast.
Right, I mean, you got to get a Comcast jibe in there.
Oh, I hear horror stories about Comcast.
That's all I ever hear, yeah. It's just bizarre. I don't know how they still exist, really, but I guess they do. Well, that and Rogers. In Rogers in Canada, I always hear
about. Yeah,
about
you hear that. Rogers. People bitching about Rogers all the time.
Yeah. Okay. So you're a little bit famous for not liking Macintoshes. And
you know what? It's not so much the actual engineering aspect of it. If I look at the hardware they provide, you know, they're nice machines, slightly overpriced. And,
yeah.
You know, for someone who, you know, doesn't want to really get too far into it, you know, buying a Mac is probably okay. My kid's sister, she's got a Mac laptop, and for her it's okay. It's a better choice than buying, say, a Windows XP box or a Vista box.
Right.
You know, but you really can't do most customization for it. And
right.
For me, as a programmer and someone who's really into computers, Linux is definitely a better choice for me.
Yeah.
The thing that kind of puts me off about Mac is the whole cult around it and the whole elitism and snarkiness of some of the people that run it.
Yeah.
Now, they think their shit doesn't stink, I get the impression sometimes.
Right. Yeah.
And it's kind of yuppie, too. You go to a Mac store and you'll take a look at the people that are in it. It's kind of yuppie-ish, you know?
Yeah, it's funny for a company that says, you know, think different and kind of tries to put themselves as a rebel company. It is surprisingly like Sunny Valley, Pleasantville, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's like California yuppie, you know, like they try to portray this image of, yeah, you know, we're old hippies, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Yeah, you know, let's stick it to the man. Bullshit, man. they are the man.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, friends of mine who are not into computers at all have already started to realize that, yeah, Mac has basically become just a sort of a twin of Microsoft in so many ways.
They really are. The only thing that makes them a little better than Microsoft is they have the sense to base their OS on a Unix derivative.
Yeah.
You know, that's about it.
Yeah, you know, I often wonder actually why Microsoft didn't just scrap everything that they'd done so far and just kind of like redesign Windows from the ground up.
You know, that's coming to a head very soon for them. And
yeah.
They're coming to a critical point in their existence, and
yeah.
If they don't cut the cord and move forward, I think they're doomed.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do.
Yeah, the next release of Windows is a critical point for Microsoft, you know?
Yeah, yeah, not, for sure.
Whether or not if they're going to be viable going forward.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you got to wonder about Microsoft because it seems like their flagship product is basically their Xbox 360 gaming console.
Right.
You got to wonder about that. You know?
Yeah. And yet this is the OS that runs our government. Yeah.
And pick it up and try to do some coding slowly. I think people, you know, their eyes are slowly being opened.
Yeah, which is great.
You know, my big gripe as Apple as a company is the whole iTunes store.
Oh, yeah. Well, that drives a lot of what they're doing, period.
You know, it's such a closed environment. I understand that in the early days, they had to make some concessions with Hollywood and, you know, the recording industry to put DRM to get their content on there.
Yeah.
But it's come to a point where, you know, they don't need to do that anymore. They can call the shots, but they still have the DRM on the system. And I know they have some music that's DRM free.
Right.
But isn't that like a premium service though?
It is a premium service.
More?
Yeah, you have to pay more for it.
And the all the videos that they offer, that's all got DRM on there too, right?
Oh yeah, that's very DRM'd. Yeah, that's and you know, I mean just thinking about Mythbox versus, for instance, their media center, Apple TV.
you can't even compare.
Yeah, it's not, you can't compare. But I mean, it really seems like the Apple TV is just basically a marketing device, you know, for you to purchase your stuff off the Apple, the iTunes store.
It's a thin client for iTunes, basically.
Exactly, exactly. That is exactly what it is, yeah.
Plug it to your TV and you got iTunes. Ooh.
Yeah, and the one port they give you, the USB port, is completely non-active.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah, yeah. All it will do is it'll boot off of a special USB like bootloader that the technicians at Apple have. I've seen it booted into that, but in terms of like going back there and putting anything, you know, useful into it, it's just not going to happen.
I'm looking at the Apple Store right now on the website, and I see their 160 gig Apple TV box is selling for $329.
Wow.
Now, my Myth box, I have a 250 gig serial ATA drive with a TV capture card.
Right.
I put that together with parts. I think I spent around $350.
Yeah.
So for $20 more, you can get a full-blown Myth box that does 10 times more what you can do with an Apple TV box.
Yeah, and like you said, the setup is now a lot easier. I mean, if you're...
Oh, way easier than it used to be.
Yeah.
And one saving grace with those Apple TV units is I hear that people are buying them secondhand and using them as thin clients for high-def Myth TV front ends.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
And I believe that... I heard, I don't know if this is true, that the Apple TV, that you can only do 720p... At least with the older units, I don't know.
With the older units, that's correct. Yeah, I'm not
sure
about the new ones.
With the old units, I believe that if you put Linux on them, you can get it to do 1080i, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised at all, because it's just the same. I mean, it's the same interior as, like, the MacBooks and things like that, which is all the typical Intel parts, you know, the 945 chipset and all that stuff. So I don't see why that wouldn't be possible.
Yeah, you got the hardware, you know, you got the components out, so.
Yeah.
So well, that's kind of cool, I guess. So there is a saving grace to those Apple TV boxes.
Well, that to me, that's the case with most Apple hardware at all. I mean, it's not you wouldn't necessarily go out and buy it because it's overpriced. But if you get it, or if you have already had it, if you have it, you might as well put Linux on it and make it actually, you know, do what it should be able to do.
Let me ask you, those old those big heavy duty Apple boxes that used to go for like $3,000-$4,000. What are they going for now?
A lot less. I mean, if you can get like the G5s, which are PowerPC chips. So, but like a quad, I guess a quad core is what they call them. So it's four G5 chips actually. I think you can get those for less than $1,000 now.
Hey, you could set one up as a nice server and put Linux on it.
Absolutely, yeah. Now Debian runs great on PowerPC.
Oh, Debian runs great on anything.
On anything.
you could install Debian on a paperclip to a freaking supercluster.
Yes, yeah, it's a fantastic distribution.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah.
That's a great project that doesn't get as much praise as it should be.
Yeah. I've it's rescued so many computers for me where other people have, you know, declared the computer dead. You know, you just put a Debian CD in there, get it bootstrapped, figure out what the problem really is, and then fix it and install it, and it's great.
Those old G4 Macs, yeah, you could still keep them going.
Yeah, absolutely.
Put some new software on there that's up to date.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you, with those G4s, did the new version of OS X run on those G4s?
Well, only the recent G4s. It has to be 867 megahertz or over. Anything older than that, the newest OS X will not run at all. I mean, I'm sure it would run, but they won't let it run. And part of that is because a lot of the parts are not aren't upgradable. So, you know, it might just be a thing about not having enough graphic memory. But since they don't let you upgrade that, you're just kind of out of luck.
So your out is you can install Linux and keep it up to date that way.
Exactly, yeah, and it runs great.
How many machines do you own?
I'm down to only like four computers right now because I had to give – I had two iMacs in here that I gave away to good causes and then a G4.
Those are the funky ones with the bright colors?
Yeah, those. Those are old. Those are G3 – I think 333 megahertz. And then I had a G4 tower that I had to get rid of, and an iMac G4 that I had to get rid of. So I'm actually in the middle of kind of changing jobs and moving, so it's kind of one of those things.
Gotcha. You don't feel like moving it with you.
Yeah. And I'll get, I mean, they're all PowerPC chips, you know, except like two, I have two Intel computers, but everything else is PowerPC, and it's just I'm getting kind of tired of, I mean, PowerPC support, I mean, it's great. I mean, Fedora and Debian both have fantastic.
It is a dying platform.
But it's going to die. You know, it's not. Yeah. It's people aren't really.
It's a shame because PowerPC is a great platform.
Yeah, I mean, I've liked it. I've had a good time with it, but I feel like it's time to move on to Intel.
AMD's good stuff, man. I've been very happy with my AMD 64s. You can put together a fairly low-cost box that's pretty powerful.
Yeah, well, I mean, that is something I'll be doing. After I move, I'm going to definitely get a good workstation, maybe an AMD 64, and, you know, try to start editing a little bit more on Linux.
Audio, video?
Video editing.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I heard a rumor that Apple's going to be dropping Final Cut Pro. Have you heard that?
I have heard it, and I don't believe it at all. That's really helping them hugely. And I mean, they just came out with Final Cut Server, which is kind of their nod to the need to be able to cluster computers together, you know, which they didn't really allow that well in the previous version of Final Cut. So it seems like they're going with it.
They're really big. I know in the effects industry, special effects, they're almost all Linux now.
Yeah, no, they did you see that Linux Journal article about the Phil Tippett movie Spiderwick Chronicles?
Yes, yes.
They're running they did all that on Linux on a Mac Pro.
A lot of them use Linux, you know, guts, you know, they base their systems on.
Yeah.
And they just develop in-house applications, specialized custom applications.
Right,
on
Linux. Yeah.
And I think in that article, they even mentioned that their workstations, which were Apples, that they even had Linux running on them, too.
Yeah. I thought that was really funny.
Now you run Linux on all your Macs, or what do? You do dual boot setups?
I have to dual boot with one of my Macs because for my job, paycheck, I have to use Final Cut Pro, the whole Final Cut suite. That one is dual booting, but every other Mac is Linux now, yeah.
Do you get, like, weird looks from people when they look at your Mac and see that it's not OS X running on it?
You know, sadly, people don't even
notice, right?
They don't notice, yeah. You know, yeah. They're not aware of that. I do get dirty looks for having covered up the Apple logo on the back of the machine with a sticker, you know, like a Linux sticker. it seems to offend them. That they notice. But the OS itself, yeah, they don't notice.
I'm looking forward to that Apple documentary coming out.
Oh, I didn't know about this.
You didn't see it?
No.
I'll give you the link. It's pretty funny. It looks really funny.
I think I know what you're talking about, actually. I think I did see something about
that. They have some teaser trailers out there, and there's some scenes in them that are, like, downright scary.
Right, yeah.
They have this picture, this one clip, they have this woman holding a Mac, and she's kind of, like, spacing out, and she's, like, stroking her Mac. And it's just like, is that a real person, or is that just, a made-up scene?
Right, yeah. It could be either. Neither would.
Yeah, it could be either.
Me,
I don't know.
You know? Yeah, that's funny.
So I'm not really a Mac owner, and I don't have any intentions of buying any time.
And no real Mac experience. So it's you disdain them just for the culture around it and the pricing around it.
You know, the culture is the real turnoff.
Yeah, I think that having been a Mac user previously, I never was really aware that there could be a computing culture, but once I got into the Linux community and sort of compared the two, I was just like, wow, the Mac community that does exist just is not a group that I would want to be associated with.
The thing that's kind of disturbing is, you know, you look at, like, Linux and the people that are into it, you know, it's all about the freedom, being able to use whatever you want, and sharing the code, and there's, like, the whole community sense of helping other people out.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get a few assholes, but any community is going to have some assholes in it.
Sure.
But for the vast majority of people involved are good people.
Yeah.
My experiences. You know, if you're coming up, there's people out there that are willing to help you. You can go to forums, IRCs.
And understands that we were all newbies at one point.
Exactly. You go to blogs. You know, there's people out there that will help you.
Yeah.
I look at some, you know, one Mac podcast that I listen to is Mac Break Weekly.
Right, right.
And I like Leo Laporte. I've interviewed him. He seems to be, like, a generally nice guy.
And he's got Floss Weekly.
Yeah, I mean, the guy's a nice guy. He's working hard. He's been doing that for a long time. But Jesus H, man, some of those guys on that podcast are such smug bastards.
I know, it's awful.
You know, I listen to some of those episodes, and I hear them talking about, like, you know, Linux, open source, and free software. I want to reach in and freaking strangle them.
Yeah, you know, because they don't, they're pretty open about, like, really being underwhelmed by it all.
and not acknowledging really in any way that so much of the Mac internal system is from that, you know, is from open source, you know?
Yeah, there is a lineage between, say, BSDs and Linux, you know?
Yeah, and you Apache and Samba, which Mac OS X will claim as their own, really. They'll say in all their marketing material, easily share between Windows machines using the SMB protocol, you know, and what they're really saying is, use Samba. But they don't say that. They don't give credit to the people who did it.
Yeah. You know, the whole BSD thing taking from BSD, you know, the BSD guys seem okay with it. So, you know, if they're okay with it, then, you know, that's their thing.
Right.
Me personally, I would have blown a gasket if I was involved in that scene.
Yeah, I know, me too. Well, I mean, I think we got a taste of that with the KDE thing, you know, I mean, where Apple took KHTML, and, I mean, for a very long time, it was on the rocks, it seemed, you know? Like, Apple wasn't really communicating with KDE very much and stuff like that, but I guess they got it ironed out from what I understand, but...
What's interesting is, you know, that recent competition where they hacked three different boxes,
yeah.
The exploit that they were able to get into the Mac, I believe, was attributed to an old version of WebKit
right.
That hadn't been updated and patched. If they had been maybe a little more open,
yeah,
maybe they wouldn't have been exploited.
Exactly. It's the openness, I think, that definitely makes Linux the strongest of these computers.
What's amazing, though, is you talk to people who like claim to be fairly technical, and for some reason they're under the impression that Apple is like an open source company, and they're not.
Right, I know. Well, if you read the OS X or the Apple marketing material, they really insinuate it. You know, they don't ever say it, although they sort of say it sometimes. But they have their little opensource.apple.com site where they try to appeal to the open source developers, and as usual, they market themselves really well, and that's what it
means.
Yeah,
their marketing department is top notch. I'll give them that much.
Yeah, that's what they have down, really, and they have down.
Well, one of the things that their marketing department has done is they've gotten into bed with the Hollywood people.
Yeah,
and on a bunch of different levels. If you haven't seen the movie Pirates of Silicon Valley, you haven't seen that film?
I have not, but I know of it, yeah.
It's an entertaining film, you know, as just a movie.
Yeah.
But it's not, there's a lot of factual errors that happen there.
I'm sure.
I mean, in the movie, they kind of portray that, you know, Apple was hot and up and coming. They were the early PC company.
Right.
I mean, yeah, they were one of the big players, but honestly, they didn't have the market share that Commodore had, or the weight that Commodore had.
Yeah.
Commodore sold millions of computers back then, tons of computers.
Wow.
But Commodore, they basically, you know, flushed it down the toilet through mismanagement.
Yeah.
Apple, with their marketing campaigns and their marketing spiel, the connections with the Hollywood people, they basically rewritten the history to make them look a little better than actually, you know, what actually happened.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, they were practically dead in the 90s, you know. I mean, that pretty much everyone figured they were going to be gone. They weren't going to make it into the millennium, so.
Yeah, they almost went under, though.
They almost, yeah, they really
Microsoft
did.
Saved their asses.
Yeah, they did.
It's that ironic.
Yeah, it's so ironic.
But in the film, they portray Steve Jobs as hating IBM to the point that he didn't see Microsoft coming at him.
I see.
Steve Wozniak, what I've seen of him, he seems like a pretty cool guy. You know, he's like the true hacker mentality type guy. Someone who's a tinker in and experiment.
I mean, it's very telling that he's not even in the business anymore.
Exactly. So. I wonder why.
Yeah. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see if he's what he's running these days. I guess he's probably still running Mac because he's probably on the board or something like that.
Probably still has mostly Macs, but I'm sure he has some other systems.
Yeah, he's got to.
I'm surprised.
Yeah. I'll try to interview him.
That would be very cool.
Yeah.
I like to interview him.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the early computing pioneers, you know.
I know, yeah.
They came and, like, maybe Chuck Peddle, you know, some of the guys from Atari, you know, all those guys would be cool to talk to.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, we've had a couple on Tech Show, we had a couple of episodes with some of those Commodore guys, and great stories, man. Some of the stuff that came out of that company, just amazing.
Oh, that's cool. I should. I have to catch up on all the old tilts, but there's so many of them. It's
we interviewed hard. Bill Hurd, who was one of the main engineers during like the 64 and the Commodore 128 era. He was phenomenal. I'm gonna try to get Dave Haney, who's like one of the big main Amiga guys.
Cool.
On at some point too.
Yeah, and Amiga. I remember seeing Amiga screenshots and things like that back. You know, when I was on my Apple II GS, but I never really. Yeah, I remember they were just really cool. I mean, they were really big on graphics, right? I mean, that was one of their big capabilities.
Yeah, one of the third third-party applications and add-ons was this thing called the Video Toaster, and it basically was a video editing suite where you could do rendering of graphics and pretty fancy stuff at the time.
Yeah.
And it was very popular, you know. I think it was, what was the company? NewTek, I think, was the company.
Wow.
And they're still around. They do other products too, but their big product was the Video Toaster. And it was used extensively on a lot of TV shows and films. I think Babylon 5 was one of the last shows that used it extensively.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, so if you're a fan of Babylon 5, that's all being done with Video Toaster. Now, the thing about the whole Amiga scene was, I think it was a little bigger in Europe than it was in the States. And a lot of people had them, but... You know, after a certain point, you know, once the company went down the tubes, it kind of died out in the States, understandably. People kind of moved on.
Right,
what's amazing is, like, so many of these people, like, stuck with it up until, like, the late 90s.
Wow.
Insane. Even in the early 2000s, people were still running them. It's like, you know, no offense, man. I love the Amiga. I thought it was one of the great platforms.
Right.
That was very undervalued and underappreciated for the time.
Yeah, yeah.
But you got to move on at some point, you know?
Yeah, I guess so. Well, it's like those BIOS guys trying to revive BIOS, you know, Haiku. It's just kind of really obscure sort of hobby sorts of projects.
It's kind of sad in a way. I mean, I can understand why people have, like, you know, attachments to their machines that they've used for so many years.
But right, yeah.
It comes to a point, man, where you just got to move on to new things, you know?
Right.
But if they want to stay with it, more power to them, I guess.
Cool. Okay, so the new thing is Linux, I guess, so everyone move to Linux. It was great having you on, Pat.
Oh, I had a great time talking to you.
Yeah.
Let's do it again sometime.
Absolutely, yeah.
You got to come up to the tech show at some point so we can do some more Apple bashing.
Next listener call-in show, I'll try to...
Yeah, you can talk some sense to Alan and Link, who are the Apple fiends.
Yeah, I keep hearing you guys say that. Does Alan really own a Mac or Macs?
He's got a couple. He's got a laptop and I think a Mac Mini, and he's also got a couple of those all old iMacs, those colored ones. Link, I think, only has one box. I think he's only got a Mac Mini.
Yeah, well, he probably came to his senses.
I don't know. He seems to like it.
Oh, okay.
He's got a ton of machines, though. Like,
he likes it is because he has other machines that when the Mac stops
all
him.
Sorts of,
yeah.
He's into all sorts of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And Dan had a Mac laptop for work. His old job, he required that he used one.
Okay.
But since he switched jobs, he got rid of it, and he's seen the light.
Yeah, that's cool.
I mean, you know, at the end of the day, honestly, my whole view of Apple is, you know, it's just another piece of hardware.
Exactly.
And there's better software to run on it.
Right, exactly. I guess that's how I feel about it. And like you say, I mean, if it works for someone, then obviously they're going to run it, and that's fine if that's what they're getting done. I hate to think that there are some people out there who believe, like you say, that the Mac is an open platform and it's so powerful and all that other stuff. You know, just because they haven't heard of Linux or they haven't heard enough about Linux.
Yep.
So hopefully they'll hear about it.
We need some more Mark Shuttleworths to pump some money into a Linux marketing campaign. IBM
absolutely.
Did it a while back, but we really need a new campaign, I think.
Yeah, that would be really cool. A good Linux campaign, I think that would be great at this point.
Plus all these devices that are running embedded Linux, man.
Oh yeah. Everywhere.
Good stuff, man. Good times ahead.
This has been The Bad Apples. If you need to contact us, it's at gort.klaatu@gmail.com. It's gort.klaatu, K-L-A-A-T-U, @gmail.com. Music, as always, was done by Fat Chance Lesta. And you can always stop by the site, thebadapples.info, for more information on The Bad Apples and free wallpapers and things like that. You can also be sure to check out Fedora Reloaded. That's the Fedora community news and information online zine podcast. It's fedorareloaded.com. You can subscribe to that and hear all about the latest and greatest Fedora news.